From the City of Angels off the Pacific Ocean, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie, and welcome to Coast AM. Last hour of the program tonight, researcher Zachariah Sitchin joins us as we talk about some of the mysteries of the world. Noted author, The 12th Planet, and a number of other works. Here's what's happening. President Barack Obama has apparently ditched U.S. plans to return to the moon and hitched NASA's future to private industry in a budget calling for the space agency to stay close to Earth and do its research. In budget proposals for NASA, President Obama proposed increased funding for the space agency by $6 billion over 5 years, but he proposed dropping the massively over-budget program to develop a new generation rocket called the Constellation, which was put in place by former President George W. Bush, which had been aimed at taking Americans back to the moon. Robert Zubrin, the inventor of several unique concepts and also How to Live on Mars, a trusty guidebook for surviving and thriving on the red planet. Robert, is this disappointing, the fact that NASA is going to be taken out of the moon mission business and it's going to be given to private industry?
Well, what's disappointing is that NASA will have no goal at all. And the stuff about private industry is basically a cop-out. Private industry is not going to go to the moon. They're going to try to contract out some deliveries of cargo to the space station by private industry, which is okay. Nothing wrong with that. Could even help reduce the cost of maintaining the space station. And in fact, given that they're shutting down the shuttle and they have canceled the Ares rocket program, they'll have no other way to deliver anything to the space station other than paying the Russians to do it. But the real problem here is simply saying that NASA will no longer have a goal.
And without that goal, Robert, it sounds like we're not going to Mars either.
Correct. I believe NASA needs a goal, and the goal should be humans to Mars. The Bush administration agreed with half of that. They said NASA needs a goal, and then they decided, well, we'll take a goal we know we can do, which is return to the moon, which I felt was an inadequate goal. And it actually put the thing on a very weak footing because it was insufficiently inspiring to have much public support. And so it left it vulnerable to exactly what has now happened. But the bottom line is, if Obama's decision is allowed to stand, it means that we're going to spend another 10 years accomplishing nothing with our human spaceflight.
We'll be waving at the Chinese and those from India when they're on the moon.
Well, yes. Eventually, they will go to the moon, and we will watch the news programs of them coming back. It really is incredible. They're going to increase NASA's funding slightly by about 5%, but they're not going to spend it with any intent to achieve anything.
No, it's just spending some money. Robert, thank you again for being on the program. Tomorrow, Richard C. Hoagland will join us for a couple hours, giving his perspective into this situation. Richard, of course, EnterpriseMission.com and our science advisor. Well, Toyota Motor Corporation says that its dealers should get parts to fix a very sticky gas pedal problem this week as the automaker tries to bring an end to a recall that has affected 4.2 million vehicles worldwide. The company said in a statement that it has begun shipping parts and is training service technicians on the repairs. Some of the dealers may stay open 24 hours to fix the 2.3 million cars and trucks affected by the recall. Here in the U.S., the automaker said that it would suspend production of 8 U.S. models affected by the recall for this week. Toyota recalled the vehicles on January 21st, determining that excess friction in the gas pedal assembly could, in rare cases, cause the pedals to stick. And that's not good news. You know, as more and more people are experiencing tough economic times, they are more apt to do some very crazy things. In St. Peter's, Missouri, a woman who forged school loan documents in her daughter's names to support a gambling habit has now been sentenced to 5 years in prison. She's 50 years old, pleaded guilty in September on 7 counts of felony forgery. Now, she admitted to taking out loans for, get this, $140,000, pretending they were for her two daughters. She also forged her mother's name as a co-signer. Prosecutors had offered to argue for no more than 9 years in prison in exchange for her pleas, and she got the 5 years. Man, unbelievable. Decades of progress in the United States on cutting cholesterol, blood pressure, and smoking are being stalled by rising obesity rates, and heart disease will kill, they say, 400,000 Americans this year. A study by British scientists found that around half of those deaths could be averted if people ate healthier food and simply quit smoking. And experts warned that there was no room for complacency when it came to heart health risks. Journalist Christian Weil watches all these heart stories for us. 400,000 deaths in the U.S. in 2010. That's sad.
Mm-hmm. Very sad. Besides the 400,000 deaths predicted from heart disease, the article could also have added that the American Diabetes Association predicted 200,000 Americans are expected to die from diabetes in the same year.
And that, again, is because of obesity, you believe?
Well, you know, George, after looking at that article, I was wondering, because first of all, yes, we do agree, we could all tighten up on our eating habits and do more exercise. But the article also alludes to the fact that cholesterol is not being controlled nearly as well as it was a few years ago. And I wonder if a major reason for that might be the fact that people have lost their homes, they've lost their jobs, and they've lost their insurance over the past few years.
And maybe their incentive.
Yes, and their incentive. And consequently also, they can't afford the statin drugs. And it can't even afford the co-pays because they're very expensive. I've just posted some natural sterol supplements for those people who are unable to continue on their expensive medications but still need to have their cholesterol in check.
They have to do something. MyHeartBook.com.
MyHeartBook.com.
Very good. Thank you. Christian Weil, and of course, he puts out his newsletter on turmeric and stem cell research, and he has just been invaluable helping coast-to-coast listeners and has even gotten some people who couldn't even walk a block or two, and you've heard them on this program. They've gone through stem cell treatment for injections right in the heart, and now they're jogging. Microsoft founder Bill Gates and his wife Melinda have said that they will donate $10 billion over the next 10 years to develop and deliver new vaccines. Gates, speaking at the World Economic Forum in Switzerland over the weekend, said the aim was to see 90% of children in developing countries immunized. Over the past 10 years, the couple's charity has committed $4.5 billion to that development of vaccines. I bet Big Pharma likes to hear that. In Iraq, a female suicide bomber detonated her explosives inside of a way station for Shiite pilgrims, killing 54 people, rattling security officials were struggling against a possible rise in violence before key elections next month. February 11 marks the anniversary of the 1979 Islamic Revolution in Iran, but Iran's president is now threatening the West with that 11th will mark a strike against global arrogance, with Iranian opposition leaders urging Iran citizens to mark the date. The anniversary of the Islamic Revolution is a symbol of freedom and of broad protest against the regime. Iran's president, Ahmadinejad, is warning Western powers, that's us, that he intends to strike against their global arrogance, as he says, on Feb 11. Iranian state television and the Iranian government did not offer any further explanation of Mr. Ahmadinejad's comments, whatever he means. In Litchfield, Connecticut, actor Rip Torn was so intoxicated when he broke into a Connecticut bank carrying a loaded gun that he thought he was home, taking off his hat and boots inside of the bank and leaving them by the door. According to court records, the 78-year-old actor was wearing the same battered boots on Monday when he was arraigned on several charges after spending the weekend at a police holding cell near his hometown of Salisbury in northwestern Connecticut. And billionaire Sir Richard Branson may already own an airline, a record label, a mobile phone company, several luxury restaurants, and a Caribbean island. But today, the entrepreneur unveiled his latest toy, an underwater plane. You can see that in stories in the news at coasttocoastam.com. The prototype submersible is called the Necker Nymph and can dive to depths of up to 130 feet. And Sir Richard hopes that one day he'll explore depths of 35,000 feet, which is far more than the height of Mount Everest. It is an amazing-looking boat or car, whatever you want to call it. Up next, UFOs in the national security state. Richard Dolan joins us. Stand by for that on Coast to Coast AM. Okay, we're back with UFO researcher Richard Dolan. He holds an MA from the University of Rochester, a BA from Alfred University. Several years ago, he published a 500-page study, UFOs in the National Security State and Unclassified History from 41 to 1973. In 2009, he completed Volume 2 of this very historical study, subtitled The Cover-Up Exposed, 73 to 91. Richard has spoken at conferences all around the world discussing the destruction of our political liberties as a result of the UFO cover-up. Here he is, back on Coast to Coast AM. Richard, how are you?
Very well, George. Thank you for having me on. It's
looking
a pleasure.
Forward. Boy, you've been busy.
A little bit.
My gosh, I've been looking at your website. We'll talk a little bit about a TV project you're working on and everything else. And that's exciting, too, by the way, Richard. So.
It's been a lot of fun, actually. I've worked with a really great group of people on that.
Tell me about Volume 2.
Well, it was five solid years, I would say, in the making. Actually, it took a little longer than that, but I would say a lot of time to write. It's about 600 pages. It's really a continuation of the first volume of history I wrote a number of years ago. For this, I really tried to cover the sum total of what I felt was important about the UFO phenomenon during two really critical decades of American and world history, the 1970s, 1980s, right up to the end of the Cold War. 1991 is where this volume breaks off. What struck me in researching this, George, was just the incredible volume of really well-documented and astonishing UFO cases. Everyone kind of knows that there's a lot to this topic. I think anyone who's really looked into it is typically struck by that fact. But what just blew my mind, even after having written my first book, was the density of really good sightings that took place around the world during those years. So that was one thing. And actually, it's what I wrote is almost three books in one. The first part of the book would be what I've just described to you, very interesting cases that I tried to describe in as concise and complete a way as I could. But there are two other themes, really, that I wove into this book. One would be maybe we would call the politics. In other words, asking the question of what is, you know, who's in charge of this secret, if there's a secret, which I believe there is.
Sure.
How does it work? Is there an attitude that we can discern by the various militaries of the world toward this and so forth? Sort of the politics of UFOs amid the backdrop also of broader geopolitics. I really try to at least highlight some of the importance of that. And then the third theme, which to me personally in some ways was the most interesting, was our own research into this topic, our own intellectual history, as it were. That is the history of what we can call ufology, our own attempt to understand this mystery. And one thing that became very clear in my study of this is that where researchers were in the early 70s was not the same place where they ended up in 1991 by the end of this story. It was a real interesting journey, and that's something that I tried to cover as well, and just weaving it all together into a narrative that I thought made sense to myself and hopefully for readers.
Did you find that with the two volumes that belief in ufology changed at all from Volume 1 to Volume 2 in terms of the years that were involved? Do people change?
Yes, I think absolutely they did. The way that people looked at the UFO phenomenon in the 1950s, let's start there, because, I mean, there was things going on in the 40s, but there really wasn't any civilian group that was looking into this until the 1950s of any note.
Right.
The 1950s and 60s, what you find, a lot of the researchers who looked into this were under the assumption that the UFO phenomenon, if they believed in UFOs at all, then they assumed that it was, you know, like you'd get in the movies, men from another planet coming to Earth to colonize or to surveil. This was the big theme, I think, of the writings of Donald Kehoe, major researcher in the 1950s.
And they all had that help mankind feel, didn't they?
Well, a lot of them did. You got what were known as the contactees back in those days. Get them today as well, of course. But back in the 50s, that was a very major school of thought, we can call it, people who believe that the Space Brothers, as they were noted, were here to help us get past the dangers of the atomic age, for example, and things of this particular sort. There was always the other side of it back then, which was the more national security-oriented side of it. People like Donald Kehoe, who was a major factor in my first volume, who argued that this is a national security issue, but that nonetheless the public had a right to know about it, and he studiously avoided this, you know, aliens are our friends theme. So there was always this division among people who looked into the topic. What happened, though, really, by the late 1960s, that the topic hit a kind of crescendo in the United States. And that, I think, was because of two things. One, primarily, I think, was because of a massive upsurge in reported sightings of UFOs, particularly in the United States. You know, every time the Air Force would issue a press release debunking the topic, it always seemed that whoever was flying the UFOs wasn't getting the memo. So they continued to fly. And by 65, 66, it was a big deal. It actually made discussion in Congress. Gerald Ford famously described his unsatisfactions over the answers the Air Force was giving. So it caused a kind of crescendo. And what happened was that the Air Force very deftly took the initiative here, and they gave the project. They gave a project to the University of Colorado.
Condon Report, right?
Exactly. And they said, here, whatever you guys decide scientifically, we'll abide by your conclusions. It certainly looks to many historians looking into this that that was a rigged game to begin with.
That was a debunker's plan, wasn't it?
Well, that's what I suggest in my first volume.
Yeah.
So then at that point, 1969, when that report was issued, that was sort of a turning point for ufology. After that, and this is really what's covered in my latest book, the people researching UFOs attempted essentially to regroup. And one of the key ways that they tried to regroup was to create what they started to call scientific ufology. And the idea of this was that, well, we got slapped down by this scientific study, so what we need to do is be more scientific. And this is the way that we'll get the scientific and academic communities to take us seriously. And it's certainly a laudable goal. And what you find in ufology of the 70s in particular is a very strong emphasis. All the major organizations promoted their version of scientific ufology. The problem, of course, anyone who does science knows to do real science, you need money. And none of these organizations had any of it. Nonetheless, I think their attitude was certainly noble and in the right place. What you find is groups like MUFON trying to create manuals for their investigators to go through the process of investigating cases in a logical, rationalized way and so on. They did what they could do. The other side of scientific ufology in the 70s was simply what I noticed is a depoliticization of the UFO topic during that time. It was almost as if the idea of the cover-up that had been promoted in the 50s and 60s, it became passé. And other ideas came to the fore, other than just the extraterrestrial visitation idea. Writers like Jacques Vallée and John Keel talked about some strange ideas for the time, interdimensionality,
right,
for example,
right.
And showing their dissatisfaction with the straightforward nuts and bolts types of ufology. So ufology really went through a kind of intellectual revolution during the 70s, I think, as a result of the Condon Committee report. And that was not all. That was a very good thing in a lot of ways. The politics came back in, though. You see, with this topic, I feel you really can never keep the politics out forever. And what happened in this case was a strengthening of the Freedom of Information Act by the mid-70s. And this is really a critical thing, because what it meant is that after 1974-75, it increasingly became possible through a petition of the government to get documents pertaining to to UFOs from all kinds of government agencies. This had not been possible before.
Let's pick that up right when we come back. Richard Dolan, our special guest tonight on Coast to Coast, author of his latest work, UFOs in the National Security State, Volume 2. We'll be back in a moment. StreamLink. For just pennies a day, you can go to coasttocoastam.com and sign up for that and get podcasting, special downloads of past archives, years gone past, and also iPhone apps and a couple other little things that'll be tossed in along the line. StreamLink, part of Coast to Coast AM. We'll be back in a moment as we continue this incredible discussion with Richard Dolan, UFOs in the National Security State, next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you with Richard Dolan, and we're going to continue our discussion about the UFO state. Richard, by the way, Richard Hoagland will be on with us a couple hours tomorrow night to talk about the lack of our moon preparation attempts, and he says hi, by the way.
Oh, great.
He's going to be highlighting some of your work in his presentation tomorrow. So.
Well, that's very, very nice to hear. I do think that's an interesting story, incidentally, George, that it's just like everything else with our society. What we're really seeing, I think, is the loss of the public space and the development of just all these little private enterprises. And I agree. You had a gentleman on earlier who talked about this as a disappointment and a real problem. And mm-hmm. I agree. I think it's a shame.
Back to the Freedom of Information Act. So you're saying that this helped you a lot.
Well, what it did is it helped, I think, all researchers interested in looking into this topic, because what we discovered is that despite years and years of denials by the military agencies, the CIA, the FBI, and so on, what we discovered, or what researchers at the time discovered in the late 1970s, once they got 10,000 documents and more, 10,000 pages of documents and more out of government files pertaining to UFOs, was that these agencies had been lying all these years, and there was some very good documentation proving their interest in UFOs. Now, at the time, this was a very energizing thing, as you can imagine, for researchers, and there were a number of them who, I wouldn't say they had any true illusions about the difficulty of this task, but I think there were people who really wondered if they just got the right document out, they might be able to crack that wall of secrecy and get some kind of formal admission that, yes, we actually are following UFOs, mm-hmm. and some of them are not of our manufacture and so forth. It didn't happen, of course. It was a lot tougher than even, I think, the most optimistic person, the most pessimistic person thought. But nevertheless, it was an important watershed in history. And one thing I want to say about these documents is that, although when you go through them, and I've read through thousands of pages of them now, there isn't really one of the confirmed documents by itself that I think would be a sufficient true smoking gun to prove that all UFOs are alien or something like that.
Right.
But what I would say is that when you take the top 50 of them, say, top 100, they make a very strong case cumulatively that this is a phenomenon, A, that's been taken very, very seriously by the U.S. military and many other militaries. This comes through very, very clear in the documentation, as well as the fact that when you read the reports of what these objects did, well, I mean, the fact is that there just isn't any conventional explanation to go with him.
Right. You know, like, Richard, in a court of law, for example, a couple witnesses can just about nail somebody, right?
That's right.
Why don't they accept the fact that eyewitness testimony from all kinds of people, including police officers and pilots and folks that are outside a lot like that, why don't they accept that kind of eyewitness testimony?
Well, I believe that in the world of intelligence or counterintelligence, they do. Look, I mean, think of it this way. If we were within some national security intelligence agency and we were getting all of these reports from people, I doubt very seriously that we would be sitting on our duffs waiting for some laboratory-tested piece of truth to fall into our laps.
Right.
No,
right.
What we would be doing is going out there and looking into this and being proactive rather than reactive to the whole thing. The problem is, think about it from a public policy point of view. And although I do spend my time essentially fighting the secrecy, I have some sympathy for their position, especially in the early years. This is a very difficult topic for them to deal with. And if you want to maintain control over the public peace, you may not just want to tell people, hey, folks, we've got this phenomenon here. We don't really know who these guys are. We can't really control them. They outclass our best fighter jets. But don't worry, we'll do our best to manage the problem. That's not a good way to deal with it. And so what you want to do, I would think, is you hold the most rigorous standards for the public. You know, in other words, saying that the UFO phenomenon doesn't pass the test of objective scientific truth, which is a different level than a court of law analogy. Although I firmly believe, and I think all of the indications point, that within the classified world, these guys were very worked up over this problem. And indeed, our military documents, the ones we have, show this.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, I think that's part of it.
Yeah.
It's a hard issue to deal with. We, you know, in our own era now, people talk a lot about UFO disclosure. Now, I often get brought into these debates because of, I guess, the nature of what I write about.
And I don't see it coming. I've said that before.
No, I don't either. I'm with you on this. Well, let me qualify what I say. I think that I see no initiatives coming from the Obama administration. I saw none through the 8 years of the George W. Bush administration. I see none now. But that doesn't mean it won't happen. My argument for some time has been that I can't really predict what I think the trigger will be for disclosure. But I do believe that when I step back a few paces and look at the radical change that has taken place within our society, 20 years of an internet have just utterly transformed our world, and we know that this transformation is not going to stop. Our society has changed. Our whole global communication system has changed. I've got to think that within another 10 or 20 years from now, we're going to look very different as a society than we do today. And it just seems to me that it would be foolish on my part to say that it's not going to happen, that the world of 20 years from now is going to look just like the world of today. So I leave it very much open that things can change. Plus the fact that we're living in the most tumultuous period of change in human history.
Oh my gosh.
There's been nothing like this. So I think it's very possible, but I don't see any incentive coming from the current presidential administration. Of course, it's an open question as to how much influence the president even has on this matter. And I've been of the opinion for some time that that's of a fairly minimal influence.
I don't think many of our past presidents even knew what was going on in this field.
No, well, I tried to find this out as well. I've been fortunate, maybe, in being able to talk with a few people who do know multiple U.S. presidents.
Mm-hmm.
Anytime I get the opportunity to ask, I ask the same question, which is, how much do the presidents know? Everyone wants to know this, of course, and no one really knows the answer. But the indications that I've gotten, and of course, these are not tantamount to proof, it's just what I've been told, is that some presidents have known more than others. And to me, what it looks like is that the trend is moving away presidential participation in this secret. I do believe that Jimmy Carter was briefed. This is something that I wrote about in my recent book. Now, it is a story that came to me, but it was from a very well-connected man, very well-connected, I would say, who indicated to me that Jimmy Carter was briefed on this topic in 1977, and in fact that it was an upsetting experience for him, or at least appeared to be. I was told that President Ronald Reagan received a briefing, mm-hmm. some kind of briefing on this.
I think Nixon did too.
Yeah, I believe so, although I don't have anyone who has been able to tell me that personally, but I think that he probably did.
I cite that story where he apparently brought Jackie Gleason down to Homestead Air Force Base and showed him some ETs that they had there.
I did my own account of that story for my book. It's early on in the book, 1973. I figured, why not? Let's put it in there.
Sure.
It's an interesting story because it came out through the ex-wife of Jackie Gleason, a lady named Beverly McKittrick. who wrote about it at first. I also do know that the UFO witness Larry Warren, who was part of the Rendlesham UK case.
Great case.
Yeah. Well, Larry Warren did speak with Jackie Gleason as well toward the end of Jackie Gleason's life and got the story directly from Jackie Gleason. All I can say is I've met Larry Warren a number of times, and I believe him. I think he's accurately.
So it came from a couple sources, basically, right?
A couple of people who have made this claim, yeah. And there's a lot of detail to it, a lot of particularly from Beverly McKittrick's account. So, yeah, what the story is that Nixon took Gleason to an Air Force base in Florida very, very late. They were very good friends. That's a known fact. And where he showed Gleason what Gleason initially thought were mangled children, but soon realized that these were not human beings.
Yeah.
And you've had people who've disputed this story, saying it's ridiculous that Nixon would have been able to escape from a Secret Service detachment, although one Secret Service ex-Secret Service man who worked with presidents said, no, Nixon was always trying to get out of Secret Service observation.
Well, Kennedy used to do that all the time, especially in New York. He'd go down to the local pub and sneak out.
Yeah, I heard this as well. And so I don't see it as an outrageously difficult thing to accept. Of course, what we don't have is, again, we don't have a proven government document, for example, signed by Richard Nixon, that says, yeah, it took Jackie Gleason to look at some alien bodies. So failing that, what we have are these stories, and I certainly think they're interesting. When I recount stories like this, I do want to emphasize, I try to be as careful as I can be in how I discuss them. So you're always making a difficult decision here. If this story is not confirmed, do you toss it out totally, or do you include it and discuss it in as illuminating a way as you can, with the understanding that making it clear to the reader that it's not a confirmed story? And I've often elected to do the latter, and that's just how I've decided to do it.
Well, I can only imagine how Nixon would have brought Jackie, I'm going to show you something you won't believe.
That's not a bad Nixon.
No, it's not bad at all. So while you were writing Volume 2, UFOs in the National Security State, did you come across some other cases that you've just found to be very blockbuster?
Yeah, I did. Some which were just completely unknown to me, and I suspect to a lot of researchers. What happened, I was very fortunate. I have had access in doing this to the given, actually, a complete collection of a lot of the old UFO journals. I mean, just the MUFON UFO Journal, the International UFO Reporter, the IUR, all the old APRO bulletins as well, which are kind of hard to find, and a bunch of others that I didn't even know existed until I got them. I was left them in a man's will, a very nice elderly gentleman. So I went through them all. I read I can say I read just about every single page of the old MUFON UFO Journal. I don't just have it, I read it. And what you find is that these cases would go in there and get some follow-up. Another one is the old British Flying Saucer Review, a really excellent journal.
Sure. Yeah,
here's
classic.
One. I would suggest that almost the entire year of 1975 might go down in history as one hell of a year for UFO cases.
Was it a flap year?
It was a significant flap year. It was a major year. It's on level with 1947 and 1952 and 1966. It's huge. And what's interesting to me is how little attention it gets. I mean, it gets some attention among researchers, but I think generally speaking, with the wider public, it doesn't seem to have much cachet. There's not a lot of people who know about it. But here's what you get in that year. You get the first major wave of what we would call triangular craft that appeared. This is over North Carolina for a little over a week in April of that year. We start getting a major upsurge of the animal mutilation phenomenon that year. We get a major event of airspace violations of U.S. bases along the northern border and into Canada that to this day are not explained. There's quite a lot of those. And we get a couple of very spectacular abduction cases. I think the most notable was the Travis Walton case, but there were some others that were actually just as interesting that got very little attention. But here's one case. It May 3rd, 1975, I actually call this a forgotten day in my book. It was a case that took place in Mexico, and there was a young pilot named Carlos de los Santos flying a small Piper aircraft. He was working on getting all of his certifications in order. Was surrounded, and this was actually confirmed by the traffic controllers who were tracking him, by three dome-shaped disc objects, one in front of him and two others on each of it near his wingtips. His controls failed. He felt his aircraft being pulled or lifted, he said, and then the objects departed. Two of them made very, very strong, high-speed, sharp turns that were observed by the air traffic controllers. And in fact, one of the objects struck the bottom of his plane and left dents and scratches. The case was investigated by MUFON, APRO, CUFOS. These were the major organizations at the time. J. Allen Hynek went down there to investigate personally. Walter Andres, longtime leader of MUFON, went down personally to look at the case. They all found this young man to be very credible. And on the very same day, in the same part of the world, but in Texas now, a craft very similar in description interfered with the operation of a truck up by San Antonio. And according to this driver, a domed disc appeared, directed a spotlight down on him. This is in the evening, in the same day. Somehow nearly knocked his truck off the road, he said. When it hovered over his truck, he said the light became a very intense red and his truck lights and engine died. And he said he saw through a kind of dome non-human beings. So now, you know, this is either a couple of people just having a really interesting day and
very creative, you know.
Yeah, but the thing that struck me when I looked at these two cases is that the description of the object was essentially identical, except in one case there were three, and in another case there was one. They were actually very close to each other geographically. I don't really know what this was, but I do know that the De Los Santos case in Mexico received a lot of serious attention, and then was kind of just forgotten for the most part.
Yeah, why did they simply fade away?
Well, they very seldom get mainstream press attention, for one. You know, my very good friend Terry Hansen, who wrote, I think, an excellent book on media involvement in the UFO phenomenon, he called it The Missing Times, I think rightly pointed out that what you find are media choke points traditionally with this. So that, in other words, with a lot of UFO cases, you would find that they would get local newspapers that would cover it. But you very seldom would get those stories picked up by Reuters or Associated Press. And so they would essentially remain as local accounts, get a little bit of play among researchers, and then simply fade away. And this is one of those cases. It's a fascinating case, and there were just so many. When I went through my research in this, another thing that struck me were the number of military cases that I really hadn't known much about. A lot of them did not take place in the United States. South America was very big. Peru had a fascinating encounter in 1980 with two successive days of fighter bomber aircraft attempting to intercept a UFO that was right next to the base.
Hey, Richard, let's take this quick break and let's come back and talk about some of these other cases. You know, and perhaps you can relate to two or three good cases for us when we come right back.